Mother's hand started sliding up the pole toward the bell's rope. That was all the sign he needed. She had been offered a chance. The irrevocable commitment had been made. He loosed the magic within himself. In one swift motion, Richard knocked an arrow. He drew string to cheek. He called the target. The arrow was away. The air hissed with the sound of the arrow's flight. The crowd gasped. Before the arrow reached the target, while the air still sizzled with its sound, Richard had the second arrow knocked and on target. With a twanging thunk, the first arrow made a solid hit, dead on where he intended it. The Queen Mother let out a clipped cry of surprise and pain. Penetrating the space between the two bones in her wrist, the arrow pinned her arm to the pole, preventing her hand from reaching the bell's rope. Her other hand started over toward the rope. The second arrow sat rock solid in the invisible notch in the air, on target, waiting. "Move toward the bell, and the next arrow goes through your right eye." The gaggle of women in black fell to their knees, wailing. The Queen Mother became still. Blood trickled down her arm. Inside, storms of anger thundered through him. Outside, he was stone. "You will hear what the spirits have commanded." Slowly, the Queen Mother let her free hand drop to her side. "Speak their words, then." Richard still held the bowstring to his cheek and had no intention of letting it relax. Though the arrow was aimed at one, his ire was directed at all. Magic burned through him at full fury. The force of rage pounded through his veins. In the past, it had always been focused on an enemy, someone specific. This was different. It was open-ended rage, rage at all those present, at everyone involved in human sacrifice. This was non-specific wrath. That made it worse. It drew more magic. Richard didn't know if it was the all-encompassing threat that drew more magic, or if it was because of all the practicing he had done with Sister Verna, enabling him to focus. But whatever the reason, he was calling forth more magic from the sword than he ever had before, more than he had known was there. The magic seethed with frightening power. The very air vibrated with it. The men about stepped back. The wailing women fell into a hush. The Queen Mother's face was white against the black of her dress. 1,000 people stood in silent terror of one. "The spirits wish no more sacrifices. It does not prove your devotion to them, only that you can kill. From now on, you must show your respect of the spirits by showing respect for the lives of the Baka Ban Mana. If you do not, the spirits will vent their wrath by destroying you. Take their threat to heart, or they will bring starvation and death to the Majendai." He spoke to the men as they pressed forward. "If any of you makes a move against me or these two women, the Queen Mother dies." They all glanced to one another, seeking courage. "You may think to kill me," he told them, the target not wavering in the slightest. "But you cannot before the Queen Mother dies. You saw the shot I made. My hand is guided by magic. I do not miss." The men backed away.
"Let him be," the Queen Mother called out. "Hear what he has to say."
"I have told you what the spirits have said. You will obey." She was silent a moment.
"We will consult the spirits ourselves."
"You would insult them? You would be admitting you do not heed their words, but your own worldly wishes."
"But we must—"
"I'm not here to bargain on their behalf. The spirits have ordered I give the sacrificial knife to this woman, so she may carry it back to her people to show them that the Majendai will no longer hunt them. The spirits will warn you of their anger by taking the seed you plant, and only when you send representatives to the Baka Ban Mana and tell them you agree to the wishes of the spirits will you be able to plant your crops. If you do not follow the spirits' wishes, you will all starve to death. We are leaving now. I will have your word that we will be granted safe leave of your land, or you will die now."
"We must consider—"
"I grant you until the count of three to give me your decision. 1, 2, 3. The Queen Mother gasped. The women in black gasped. The crowd gasped. "What have you decided?" The Queen Mother held her free hand up, imploring he hold his arrow.
"You may go. You have the word of the Queen Mother that you may leave our land unharmed.
A wise decision." Her hand closed into a fist, one finger pointed toward them.
"But this is a violation of our agreement with the wise women. The accord is at an end. You must leave our land at once. You are banished."
"So be it." Richard said. But keep to your word, or you will reap the grim rewards of any imprudent action. He released the tension from the bow. Standing in his stirrups, he pulled the sacred knife from his belt and held it up high for all to see. This woman will take this back to her people and tell them of the words of the spirits. As to their part, the Baka Ban Mana may no longer make war on the Majendai. You may no longer make war on them. You will be two peoples at peace. Neither may harm the other. Heed the words of the spirits or bear the consequences. His voice dropped to a fierce whisper, yet the wrath of the magic carried the words to the farthest corners of the square, and in the stillness, every ear could hear them. Heed my orders or suffer what I will bring upon you. I will lay waste to you. Magic lay over the square like fog in a valley, ethereal yet real, a palpable manifestation of his outrage that touched everyone present, and all trembled at that touch. Richard leapt off his horse. The men shrank back a few more steps. Sister Verna was speechless with rage. He had never seen her in such a state. She stood, as if paralyzed, with her fists out before her. Richard leveled his glare and his wrath on her. Get on your horse, sister. We're leaving. Her jaw looked ready to shatter under the pressure of how tightly it was clenched. You're mad. We will not. Richard thrust a finger toward her. If you wish to argue with someone, sister, you may stay and argue with these people. I'm sure they will oblige you. I'm going to the palace to get this collar off. If you want to go with me, then get on your horse. There is no way. We cannot now travel the Horn of the Majendai land. We are banished. Richard lifted his thumb to Duchailu. She will guide us to the Palace of the Prophets, through the Baka Ban Mana's land. Duchailu folded her arms and gave the sister a self-satisfied smile. Sister Verna looked from her to Richard. You are truly mad. We cannot... Richard gritted his teeth with a growl, the sword's anger still at full fury. If you wish to go with me to the palace, get on your horse. I'm leaving. Duchailu watched as Richard stuck the green-handled knife behind her buckskin belt. I have charged you with a responsibility. You will live up to it. Now get up on that horse. Duchailu unfolded her arms in sudden worry, looking to the horse and back to him. She folded her arms again and put her nose in the air. I will not ride on that beast. It stinks. So do you, Richard roared. Now get on that horse! She flinched back, eyes wide in fright at his glare. She swallowed, gulping air. Now I know what a seeker is. She scrambled awkwardly up onto Geraldine. The sister was already atop Jessup. Richard vaulted up onto Bonnie. With a last warning look at the men gathered, he squeezed his horse's ribs, and she sprang into a gallop. The other two horses took out after them. The men swept back out of the way. The magic hungered for blood, raged for it. Richard wished someone would try to stop him. No one did. Please, Duchailu said. It is almost dark. May we please stop, or at least allow me to walk? This beast is hurting me. She was holding on for dear life, bouncing in the saddle as Geraldine trotted along. The little strips of colored cloth on her dress were all aflutter. He could hear Sister Verna's horse trotting along behind, but he didn't look back at her. Richard glanced up at the sun setting beyond the thick tangle of branches. His rage was finally withering with the light. For a time, it had seemed as if he would never be able to put it down. Duchailu pointed past him with her chin to his right, afraid to lift a hand. There is a small pond there through the reeds, and a grassy place before it. Are you sure we are in Baka Ban Mana land? She nodded. For the last few hours, this is our land. I know this place. All right, we will stop for the night. He held her horse for her as she slid off. With a groan, she rubbed the flats of her hands on her bottom. If you make me ride that beast again tomorrow, I will bite you. For the first time since they had left the Majendai, he was able to smile. As Richard went about unsaddling the horses, he sent Duchailu to get water in a canvas bucket. While she went off through the reeds and rushes to the pond, Sister Verna gathered wood and used her magic to set it afire. When he was finished, caring for the horses, he put them on long tethers so they could graze on the grass. I guess introductions are in order, Richard said when Duchailu returned. Sister Verna, this is Duchailu. Duchailu, this is Sister Verna. Sister Verna seemed to have cooled, or at least put a mask over her anger. I am pleased for you, Duchailu, that you did not have to die this day. Duchailu glared. Richard knew she thought of the Sisters of the Light as witches. "I do feel sorrow, however," the sister added, "for all those who will die in your place. You are not pleased for me. You wish me dead. You wish all the Bakaban Mana to die. That is not true. I wish no one to die, but I know I could not convince you of that. Think what you will." Duchailu took the sacrificial knife from her belt and held the handle in front of Sister Verna's eyes. "They kept me on that chain for 3 moons." She looked to the green handle and pointed to one of the obscene couplings carved on it. "Those dogs did this to me." Sister Verna glanced to the knife as Duchailu tapped a finger to another scene. And this too. Sister Verna watched the other's chest heaving in ire. "There is no way I could convince you, Duchailu, how much I abhor what they did to you and what they intended to do. There are many things in this world that I abhor, but can do nothing about, and in some cases must tolerate in order to serve a greater good." Duchailu patted her belly. "I have lost my moon flow. Those dogs have put me with child. Now I must go to the midwives and ask them for herbs to shed the child of a dog." Sister Verna clasped her hand before herself. "Please, Duchailu, don't do that. A child is a gift from the Creator. Please don't reject his gift." "Gift? This great Creator has a wicked way of bestowing his gifts." "Duchailu," Richard said, "up until now the Majin Dai have killed every Bakaban Mana they have captured. You are the first to be freed. They will kill no more. Think of this child as symbol of the new life between your peoples. For that new life, for all your children to flourish, the killing must stop. Let the child live. It has done no harm." "The father has done harm," Richard swallowed. "Children are not necessarily evil just because the father was. If the father is evil, then the child will be as he." "That is not true," the sister said. "Richard's father was an evil man who killed many people, yet Richard seeks to preserve life. His mother knew that the guilt of crimes does not pass beyond the one who commits them. She did not spare her love because Richard's father raped her. Richard was raised by good people who taught him right. Because of that, you are alive today. You can teach the child right." Duchailo's fury faltered as she looked to Richard. "Is this true? Your mother was treated as I, by an evil dog?" Richard could only manage a nod. She rubbed her belly. "I will consider what you say before I decide. You have returned my life. I will weigh your words." Richard squeezed her shoulder. "Whatever you decide, I'm sure it will be for the best." "If she lives long enough to decide," Sister Verna said, "you've made promises and threats that you cannot fulfill. When the Majin Dai plant their crops and nothing happens, they will lose their fear of what you have told them today. What you've done will count for nothing, and they will once again make war on her people, to say nothing of mine." Richard pulled the leather thong with the birdman's whistle off over his head. "I wouldn't say nothing is going to happen, sister. Something is indeed going to happen." He hung the whistle around Duchailu's neck. "This was a gift to me, and now my gift to you, so that you can stop the killing." He held the carved bone up. "This is a magic whistle. It calls birds, more birds than you've ever seen in one place before. I'm counting on you to fulfill my promise. You are to go to their planting fields. Keep yourself hidden. Then at sunset, blow on this magic whistle. You will hear no sound, but the birds will be called by the magic. In your mind, keep picturing birds. Think of all the birds you know as you blow on the whistle, and keep blowing until they come." She touched the carved bone whistle. "Magic? The birds will truly come?" He gave her a one-sided smile. "Oh, yes, they'll come. There is no doubt of that. The magic will call them. No person will hear the sound, but the birds will. The Majin Dai will not know it's you who calls the birds. The birds will be hungry and will devour all the seed. Every time the Majin Dai plant seeds, you call the birds and take it away from them." She grinned. "The Majin Dai will starve to death." Richard put his face close to hers. "No, this is my gift to you to stop the killing, not a gift to help you kill. You will call the birds to steal their seed until the Majin Dai agree to live in peace with you. When they have fulfilled their part of the bargain, you must fulfill your part and agree to live in peace with them." He put his first finger right in front of her nose. "If you misuse my gift, I will come back and use other magic against your people. I've placed my trust in you to do right. Do not fail my trust. Duchilo averted her eyes. She gave a little sniff. I will do right. I will use your gift as you say. She tucked the whistle into her dress. Thank you for helping to bring peace to my people. That is my greatest hope. Peace. Peace, Sister Verna huffed. She directed a smoldering glare to Richard. You think it's so simple? You think that after 3,000 years you can simply decree that the killing will stop? You think all it takes is your mere presence and the ways of people will change? You are a naive child. Though the crimes of the father do not pass on to the son, you have a simplistic way of seeing things that brings harm just the same. If you think, sister, that I would be a party to human sacrifices for any reason, you are seriously mistaken. He started to turn away, but then turned back. What harm have I brought? What killing have I started? She leaned toward him. Well, for one thing, if we don't help ones with the gift like you, it will kill them, as it would kill you. How do you propose we get those boys to the palace? We can no longer cross the Majendai's land. She glanced to Duchilu. She has only given you pass through her land. She has not said we may bring others through. She straightened. Those boys will die because of what you have done. Richard thought about it a moment. He was exhausted. Using the sword's magic had wearied him as it never had before. He wanted nothing more than to sleep. He didn't feel like solving problems or arguing. At last, he looked to Duchilu. When you make peace with the Majendai, before you let them plant once again, you must add another condition. You must tell them that in honor of the killing being brought to an end, in honor of the peace, they will let the sisters cross their land. She watched his eyes a moment before she finally nodded. Your people will do the same. He narrowed his eyes at the sister. Satisfied? In the valley, when you struck down a beast, 1,000 snakes sprang forth from its corpse. This is no different. It would be impossible, she said, for me to accurately recall all the lies you've told today. I've reprimanded you before for lying and cautioned you not to do it again. I told you not to swing the axe today, and you did it anyway, despite my warning. I can scarcely tally all the commands you've managed to violate in this one day. What you've done has not finished the killing, but only begun it. In this, sister, I am the seeker, not your student. As seeker, I have no tolerance for human sacrifice. None. The deaths of others are a separate issue. You cannot use it as a link to justify murder. There will be no compromise in this, and I don't think you want to punish me for stopping something I would wager you wish had been stopped long ago. The muscles in her face relaxed. As a sister of the light, I have no power to change things, and under obligation to save more lives, I had to uphold what has been for 3,000 years. But I admit I hated it, and in a way I'm glad you have taken it out of my hands. But that does not negate the trouble it will cause, or the deaths. When you put the Radahan on, you told me that holding the leash to that collar would be worse than wearing it. Your words are proving true. Her lower eyelids filled with glistening moisture. You have made my greatest love, my calling, a misery. I am past wanting to punish you for your disobedience. In a few days we will be at the palace, and I will at last be finished with you. They will have to deal with you. We shall see how they handle you when you displease them. I believe you will find they are not prepared to be as tolerant as I have been. They will use that collar, and when they do, I also think they will come to regret holding your leash more than I do. I think they will come to regret trying to help you, as I do. Richard put his hands in his back pockets as he stared off at the thick forest of oak and leather leaf. I'm sorry you feel that way, sister, and I guess I can understand it. Although admit I have fought being your prisoner, this today was not about you and me. This was about what is right. As one who would wish to teach me, I would hope you shared that moral stance. I would hope the sisters would not want to teach the use of the gift to one who could easily bend his convictions to the circumstance. Sister Verna, I was not trying to displease you. I simply could not live with myself if I allowed a murder to take place under my nose, much less participated in it. I know, Richard, but that only makes it worse because it's all one and the same. She unclasped her hands and peered about at the fire and their supplies, finally pulling a cake of soap from a saddlebag. I'll make a stew and bannock. She tossed the cake of soap to him. Duchailu needs a bath. Duchailu folded her arms in a huff. While I was chained to a wall, the dogs who came to mount me did not offer me water so I could smell pretty for you. Sister Verna squatted down, pulling supplies out. I meant no offense, Duchailu. I simply thought you would want to wash the dirt of those men off you. If it were me, I would want nothing more than to try to wash the feel of their hands from my flesh. Duchailu's indignation faltered. Well, of course I would. She snatched the soap from Richard. You smell of that beast you ride. You will wash too, or I will not want to be near you, and will send you off to eat by yourself. Richard chuckled. If it will keep the peace with you, I'll wash too. As Duchailu marched off toward the pond, Sister Verna called quietly to him. He waited next to her while she pulled a pot from a saddlebag. Her people have been killing any magic man they could get their hands on for the last 3,000 years. There is no time to give you a history lesson. She looked up to his eyes. Old habits spring to hand as easily as a knife. Don't turn your back on her. Sooner or later, she is going to try to kill you. Her quiet tone unexpectedly raised bumps on his flesh. I'll try to keep myself alive, sister, so you can deliver me to the palace and at last be free of your onerous charge. Richard hurried toward the pond and caught up with Duchailu as she was walking through the reeds. Why do you call that your prayer dress? Duchailu held her arms out, letting the breeze ruffle the strips of cloth on her dress. These are prayers. What are prayers? You mean the strips of cloth? She nodded. Each is a prayer. When the wind blows and they fly, each sends a prayer to the spirits. And what do you pray for? Every one of these prayers is the same, from the heart of the person who gave me their prayer. They are all prayers to have our lands returned to us. Your land? But you are in your land. No. This is where we live, but it is not our land. Many ages ago, our land was taken by the magic men. They banished us here. They reached the edge of the pond. Puffs of breeze drew up ripples in dark patches. The bank was grassy with thick patches of rushes to each side extending out into the water. The magic men took your land? What land? They took our land from our ancestors. She pointed in the direction of the Valley of the Lost. The land on the other side of the Majendai. I was going to our land with our prayers to ask the spirits if they would help our land be returned to us, but the Majendai caught me, and I was not able to take our prayers to the spirits. How will the spirits return your land to you? She shrugged. The old words say only that we must send one every year to our land to pray to the spirits, and if we do, our land will be returned. She untied her belt and slipped it to the ground. With unsettling grace, she tossed the green-handled knife aside, sticking it in the round end of a branch on a log. How? She gave him a curious frown. By sending us our master. I thought you were the Baka Ban Mana, those without masters. She shrugged. Because the spirits have not sent us one yet. While Richard was puzzling over this, she reached down, took hold of her dress, and pulled it off over her head. What do you think you're doing? She frowned. It is me that I must wash, not my dress. Well, not in front of me. She looked down at herself. You have already seen me. I have not grown any different since this morning. She looked up at him. Your face is red again. Over there, he pointed. Go on the other side of the rushes, you on one side and me on the other. He turned his back to her. But we only have one soap. Well, you can throw it to me when you're through. She came around to the front of him. He tried to turn again, but she followed him around, grabbing at his buttons. I cannot scrub my own back, and it is not fair. You have seen me, so I should see you. That is why you are turning red, because you have not been fair. This will make you feel better. He slapped her hands away. Stop it, Duchailu. Where I come from, this is not proper. Men and women do not bathe together. It's just not done. He turned his back to her again. Not even my third husband is as shy as you. Third? You have had three husbands? No, I have five. Richard stiffened. Have? He turned to her. What do you mean, have? She looked at him as if he had asked if trees grew in the forest. I have five husbands and my children. And how many of those do you have? Three, two girls and a boy. A wistful smile came to her. It is a long time since I have held them. Her smile turned sad.
My poor babies will have cried every night thinking I am dead. No one ever returned from the Majendai before.
She grinned. My husbands will be anxious to draw lots to see who will be the first to try to give me another child. Her smile faded and her voice trailed off. But I guess a Majendai dog has already done that. Richard handed her the soap. It will all turn out fine. You'll see. Go bathe. I'll go on the other side of the rushes. He relaxed in the cool water, listening to her splash, waiting for her to finish with the soap. A mist thickened over the pond, stealing slowly, silently into the surrounding trees. I've never heard of a woman having more than one husband. Do all the Baka Ban Mana women have more than one husband? She giggled.
No, only me.
Why you?
The water stopped splashing. Because I wear the prayer dress, she said, as if it should be self-evident.
Richard rolled his eyes. Well, what does...
She came swimming through the rushes toward him. Before you can have the soap, you must wash my back.
Richard let out an aggravated sigh. All right. If I wash your back, will you then go back on your side? She presented her back to him.
If you do a proper job.
When she was satisfied, she finally went back to get dressed while he washed. She told him over the chirp of bugs and the trill of frogs that she was hungry. He was pulling his pants on while she called for him to hurry so they could eat. He threw his shirt over his shoulder and ran to catch up with her as she headed toward the smell of cooking. She looked much better, clean. Her hair looked like a normal person's instead of a wild animal's. She looked no more like a savage, but somehow noble. It wasn't dark yet, but getting close to it. The mist that had formed over the pond was drifting in around them from behind. The trees were disappearing in the gathering fog. As the two of them stepped into the ring of light around the fire, Sister Verna stood. Richard was putting his right arm through his sleeve when he froze at the wide-eyed look on Sister Verna's face. She was staring at his chest, at the thing he had never let her see before. At the scar, at the handprint burned there, at the handprint that was a constant reminder of who fathered him. Sister Verna was as white as a spirit. Her voice was so soft, he had to strain to hear her.
Where did you get that?
Duchilo was staring at the scar, too. Richard pulled his shirt closed. I told you before, Darkenrall burned me with his hand. You said I was only having visions. Her gaze slowly rose to meet his. Her eyes were filled with something he had never seen in them before. Unbridled fear.
Richard, she whispered. You must not show anyone at the palace what you have upon you, except the prelate. She may know what to do. You must show her, but no one else.
She stepped closer.
Do you understand? No one.
Richard slowly buttoned his shirt. Why?
Because if you do, they will kill you. That is the mark of the Nameless One.
Her tongue wet her lips.
Sins of the Father.
From the distance came the plaintive howl of wolves. Duchilu shuddered and hugged herself as she stared off into the deepening fog.
People will die tonight,
Duchilu whispered. Richard frowned at her. What are you talking about?
Wolves. When wolves howl like that in the mist, they are foretelling that people are to die violently in the night. In the mist.
Chapter 44. They materialized out of fog and mist, the white fangs of death. The startled prey, at first immobilized by bone-chilling fright, jumped to flee before the white death. Fangs of white steel ripped into them without mercy as they bolted for their lives. Death squeals tore the night air with their terror. Hysteria sent them running heedlessly onto the waiting cold white steel. Fearless men tasted fear before they died. Pandemonium spread on a wild uproar of noise. The ringing chime of steel, the splintering of wood, the ripping of canvas, the groan of leather, the pop of bones, the whoosh of fire, the crash of wagons, the thuds of flesh and bone hitting ground, and the screams of men and beast all joined into one long cacophony of terror. The wave of white death drove the tumult before it. The sharp smell of blood washed through the air. Over the sweet aroma of blazing wood, the acrid tang of igniting lamp oil, the smoky smack of flaming pitch, and the gagging stench of burning fur and flesh. What wasn't wet with the cold mist was greasy slick with hot blood. The white steel fangs now were coated with blood and gore. White snow became a soggy mat of red splashes. The cold air was seared by gouts of flame that leapt up to turn the white fog an incandescent orange. Sinister, dark clouds of smoke hugged the ground while the sky burned overhead. Arrows zipped past, spears arced through the air, splintered lances spun away into the mist, and severed pike heads whirled off into the darkness. Remnants of torn tents flapped and fluttered, as if battered by a furious storm. Swords rose and fell in waves driven by the grunts that accompanied frantic effort. Men ran in every direction, like frenzied ants. Some tumbled to the ground, spilling their viscera across the snow. One of the wounded, blinded by blood, stumbled aimlessly until a white shadow swept by, a spirit of death, cutting him down. A wagon wheel bounced past, its progress quickly obscured from view by dark curtains of acrid smoke that drifted past. No alarm had been raised. The sentries were long dead. Few in camp had realized what was happening until it was upon them. The camp of the Imperial Order had lately been a place of noise and wild celebration, and for many, in their drunken state, it was hard to tell that anything of consequence was happening. Many of the men, poisoned by the bandu in the ale, lay sick around fires. Many were so weak they burned to death without trying to escape flaming tents. Others were in such a drunken stupor that they actually smiled at the men who drove swords through their guts. Even the ones who were not drunk, or who were not drunk to the point of dullness, didn't truly appreciate what was happening. Their camp was often a place of raucous noise and confusion. Huge bonfires roared throughout the night for warmth and as gathering places. They were generally the only reference points in the disorderly layout, so the fires of destruction caused little concern except in the immediate area. Among Dharans, fighting in the camps was simply part of the revelry, and men screaming when they were stabbed in altercations was not noteworthy. What one had was only his if he was fierce enough to keep it from the others who were always ready to take it. Alliances among Dharans were shifting sands that could last a lifetime or, more commonly, for as little as an hour when a new alliance became more advantageous or profitable. The drinking and the poison dulled their grasp of the sheer volume of screams. In battle, they were disciplined, but when not in battle, they were ungoverned to the point of anarchy. Pay for Dharans on expeditions was in large part a share of the plunder. They had looted Ebenezia despite all their talk of a new law, and having that new plunder made them perhaps less than single-minded in their devotion to duty. At battle, or the first sound of an alarm, they became a single unified fighting machine, almost an entity of one mind, but in camp, without the overriding purpose of war, they became thousands of individuals all bent on serving their own self-interest. Without an alarm to warn them, they paid the added noise and screaming little attention. Above the noise of their own business, trading, stories, laughter, drinking, gambling, fighting, and whoring, the unheralded battle a short distance away went largely unnoticed. The officers would call them if needed. Without that call to duty, their life was their own, and someone else's troubles were not theirs. They were unprepared when the white death materialized. The sight of white spirits appearing among them was a paralyzing force. Many a man wailed in fear of the Shahari spirits. Many envisioned that the separation between the world of the living and the world of the dead had evaporated, or that they had somehow been suddenly cast into the underworld. Without the ale, both poisoned and unadulterated, it might not be so. As it was, the drink and their confidence in their numbers and strength left them vulnerable, as they would never be again. But not all were drunk or dull. Some rose up fiercely. Kaelin watched it all from atop her dancing war horse. In a sea of raw, unbridled emotion, she wore her confessor's face. These men were neither moral nor ethical. They were animals who lived by no rule but might. They had raped the women at the palace and had mercilessly butchered the people of Ebenezia, from the aged down to newborn babes. A man lunged through the ring of steel around her, grabbing at her saddle for support. He gaped at her, crying a prayer for mercy from the good spirits. She split his skull. Kalin wheeled her horse to face Sergeant Cullen. "Have we captured the command tents?" The sergeant signaled, and one of the white naked men ran off to check as they drove deeper into the camp of the order. When she spotted the horses, she gave the signal. From behind, she heard the sound of galloping hooves and the sharp rattle of chains, scythes of death, come to reap a crop of the living. With a sound like a boy running past a picket fence with a stick in hand, the chain scythes being pulled at a full charge reaped a snapping of bone that meshed into a long, clacking roar. The beast screams, and the dull thuds as they slammed the ground drowned out the sound of galloping hooves and breaking bone. Even the drunken enemy turned from the white spirits to stare at the ghastly spectacle. It was the last thing they saw. Men stumbled from their tents to watch without understanding what it was that was occurring before their eyes. Others wandered aimlessly, mugs in hand, as if at a fair, drunkenly looking from one sight to another. There were so many, some had to wait a bit for their turn to die. Some were not drunk and saw not spirits, but men painted white. They saw an attack and understood well-honed blades coming for them. A pocket of fierce counterattack was surrounded and broken, but not without cost. Kalin rallied her men and drove her wedge of white steel deeper into the heart of the enemy's camp. She saw two men on huge draft horses, she couldn't see who they were, having cut down all the horses they could find, take to charging down a line of tents, reaping havoc as well as helpless men. The chain caught something as solid as bedrock. It whipped the horses around into a brutal collision. The riders went down. Men with swords and axes swarmed over them. A man with sword to hand and sober, she was alarmed to note, appeared suddenly next to her leg. He looked up with a fierce glare. His sharp eyes made her feel suddenly nothing more than a naked woman sitting on a horse. He took all of her in.
"What the?"
A foot of steel erupted from his breastbone, driving a grunt from his lungs.
"Mother Confessor!"
The naked man behind yanked his sword free and pointed with it.
"The command tents are over there!"
A movement to the other side caught her attention. With a backhanded swing, she caught the side of a stumbling drunk's neck.
"Let's go to the command tents now!"
Her men abandoned the enemy they were decimating to follow her as she jumped Nick over men and fires and crumpled wagons. As they followed, they didn't stop to slaughter the confused, panicked, and drunken Daharans everywhere, but cut down those they could if it didn't slow their pace. Where necessary, they engaged the sporadic resistance. The large command tents were surrounded by her white galleons. They held a small group of about 15 men at sword point. Before them lay a neat row of at least 30 bodies on their backs in the snow. Others of her men were throwing battle standards and flags atop a large pile already smoldering and burning in the fire. Empty casks lay scattered in the snow. When their army had come under attack, the commanders had issued no orders. The army of the Imperial Order was without benefit of direction. Lieutenant Sloan pointed with his sword to the line of bodies.
"These officers were already dead. The poison did its work. These others were still alive, although not in the best of health. They were all lying about in their tents. We could hardly get them up. They asked us for rum, if you can believe it. We've held them, like you said."
Kalin surveyed the faces of the bodies in the snow. She didn't see what she wanted. She looked to the faces of the captured officers. He wasn't there, either. She directed her confessor's face to a Keltish officer at the end of the line.
"Where's Riggs?"
He glared at her, and then spat. Kalin lifted her gaze to the man holding him. She drew her finger across her throat. He didn't hesitate. The officer went down in a heap. She looked to the next officer.
"Where's Riggs?"
His eyes darted about.
"I don't know."
Kalin drew her finger across her throat. As he went down, she looked to the next man, a Daharan commander.
"Where's Riggs?"
His eyes were wide, but not at the two bleeding bodies beside him. His horror was for her. A spirit before him. He wet his lips.
"He was hurt by the Mother Confessor. I mean, by you, before."
His voice trembled.
"When you were alive."
"Where is he?" He winced, shaking his head vigorously.
I don't know, Great Spirit. He was hurt. His face was cut by the horse. He is being tended to by the surgeons. I don't know where their tents are.
Who knows where the surgeons' tents are? Most trembled and shuddered as they shook their heads. Kaelin stepped her horse down the line of officers. She stopped before one she knew. General Karsh, I am very pleased to see you again. Where's Riggs?
Wouldn't tell you if I knew.
He grinned as he leered up at her.
You look better naked than I fancied. Why are you whoring with this lot? We could do you better than these boys.
The man holding him twisted his arm until he cried out,
Show respect for the Mother Confessor, you Keltish pig!
Respect? For a whore holding a sword? Never!
Kaelin leaned toward him. These boys have you under their blades. Everyone is a better man than you, I would say. You wanted war, Karsh. You have your wish. You have war now. A real war, not a slaughter of women and children, but a war led by me, the Mother Confessor. A woman. War without quarter. She sat up straight in her saddle, letting his eyes linger on her breasts. I have a message, Karsh. A message for the Keeper. You will be with him presently. Tell him, I said to make plenty of room. I'm sending all his disciples home. Her gaze swept down the line of men holding the officers. She drew a finger across her throat in a quick gesture. The response was just as quick. As the bodies tumbled forward, she cried out, her hand darting to her neck. A stinging pain jolted her. It was in the exact same place. It was the pain of Darkin Rawl's lips on her neck, the pain she had felt when he had come to them in the spirit house, when he had burned Richard with his hand. When he had kissed her neck and silently promised her unimaginable horrors. Men rushed forward.
Mother Confessor, what is it?
She took her hand away. Blood coated her white fingers. She couldn't say how she knew, but she knew without doubt that the blood was drawn by the perfect snow-white teeth of Darkin Rawl.
Mother Confessor, there's blood on your neck.
It's nothing. I'm all right. I must have just been nicked by an arrow, that's all.
She gathered her wits and courage, put the head of every officer on a pole for all their men to see, to let them know they are without leaders, and hurry. By the time the last dripping head was hoisted up, Daharans were pouring in from all sides. Most were drunk, laughing as if it were nothing more than a drunken brawl. But inefficient and clumsy as they were, their numbers were alarming. They were like a swarm of bees. For everyone knocked down, 10 replaced him. Her men fought fiercely, but they were no match for the overwhelming numbers sweeping in. Men she had talked to, reassured, inspired, yelled at, and smiled to, were falling with cries of pain and terror. They had been here too long. Ahead, a pitched battle erupted. The Galleons were being driven back. If they were driven back, they had no chance of escape. They couldn't go back the way they had come. Back to men who would have had the time to have been sobered up by the carnage around them, to gather their senses and their spirit. Without surprise, they were nothing but a bunch of naked boys and one woman. If they tried a second time what had worked once, they would all die. They had to cleave their way through the order, to the other side of the valley. Daharans hacked in at the white forms. Her ankle was grasped by a powerful hand. She hewed it off and shook her foot to shed the disembodied hand. They were in danger of being swallowed into the belly of this beast. Disregarding the death cries of her men, disregarding her promise not to leave the protective ring of the fiercest Galleon swordsman, disregarding her promise not to deliberately put herself into peril, Kaelin charged Nick into the thick of the battle, and beyond, into the enemy. Her sword stabbed to each side, into any enemy close enough. Teeth gritted, she swung at flesh and bone. Her wrist tingled from the jarring impacts, and her arm was so weary she feared she would not be able to lift the sword much longer. Frightened that she would be taken down, her men poured ahead toward her with renewed resolve. They drove the dark wave back, rolling over it as she urged her horse forward into the sea of dark leather uniforms. She stood in the stirrups, holding her sword high.
For Ebenicia! For her dead! For her spirit!
It had the desired effect. Men of the Order who were confused by the white enemy, but were nonetheless determined to crush them, whatever they were, stopped and stared openly at a white, naked woman atop a horse suddenly in their midst. Their faith that the attack was from men and not spirits faltered. They gaped in open astonishment. She swept her gaze around at all the eyes peering up at her. She swung the white sword in a circle over her head as a breeze ruffled her white hair back off her shoulders. "In the name of their spirits, I have come to avenge them!" Leather-clad men fell to their knees, dropping their swords, pressing prayerful hands together. They held those hands up to her. They wailed for protection. They called for her mercy. They cried for forgiveness. Had they been sober, she wondered, would the illusion be so convincing? As it was, the effect was apocalyptic.
"We grant no quarter!"
As all faces stared up toward her, as eyes shed tears of trepidation, weapons set upon them from behind, the sudden, violent, merciless wave of hard steel terrified them, convinced them that the spirits would have them all. They broke and ran, dropping weapons, screaming in fear of the underworld. They had done what they had come to do. Time was now against them. They needed to escape. They charged onward, a deadly, swift river of white that poured over and around the tents and fires and wagons and men, surprising ever more of the lethargic enemy, killing as many as they could while rolling ahead. White death moved into the mist once again. Kaelin glanced behind and saw the pairs of draft horses, their riders holding the chains up between them. She waved them into the stream of white, urging them to move faster. They started unhooking one end of the chains from the hame hooks and looping the chain over the horn on the other horse to give each horse freedom now that they needed to make a quick escape. In the distance, in the fog to the right, she saw a line of picketed horses. She saw Bryn and Peter come together, snap the end of the chain over the other hook again, and urge Daisy and Pip into gallops. She thought to scream at them, to order them to keep with the others, that they couldn't hope to get them all, that they had done enough and must leave now, that it was too late. But she knew they wouldn't hear her. Bryn dropped the loops of chain. They spread the horses to pull the steel taut as they peeled away toward the picket line of horses. The hooves of the big horses thundered across the ground. She took a last look at Bryn and Peter, knowing it would be the last time she ever looked upon them in this world, and then turned her attention ahead. She pointed with her sword.
"There are the rest of the supply wagons!"
The men knew what to do. As she charged the column past, the wagons were doused with lamp oil. Wheels were staved in and torches thrown. The wagons erupted in flame. More torches set fire to tents. The men brought awake by the noise and fire found blades sweeping at them. The fires faded into an orange glow in the mist behind as they plunged onward into the fog. Suddenly they broke free of the camp and were in open snow. Now that they were away from the camp and its fires, the darkness pressed around them. The men in front faltered, looking about as they jogged.
"Scouts forward!" she yelled. "Where are the scouts?"
Two men charged through the ranks to the fore, pointing out the direction of the pass they sought. She looked for the others, turning from side to side. None came. She galloped Nick to the van, after the two scouts.
"Where are the others? They were ordered to be in the lead."
The round, wet eyes that looked up at her answered her question without words.
"All right," she said. "You two know the way. Get us out of here."
50 men had scouted the pass they wanted. 50, to be sure, there would be a good number left to show the way. 2 were left. With a silent growl, she cursed the spirits. Shamefaced, she called the curse back. They had at least left her those 2. Without them, they would be left to wander in the fog, freezing, and invincible to the men of the order chasing them. She pulled Nick to a halt beside the stream of naked men. She swooped her arm frantically.
"Move, move, move! Run, curse you, run! They'll be on top of us!"
The men on the draft horses, Bryn and Peter, not among them, came abreast of her.
"Drivers, watch for the scout ahead. He'll show you the stakes to follow."
They nodded that they remembered. Men in Daharan uniforms with white cloth swatches sewn into their epaulets, to show that they were in fact the Galleon men who had infiltrated the enemy camp in the uniforms of the sentries, ran past.
"Don't forget to pull up the stakes before you get up on the horses."
They were to double or triple up on the draft horses and ride to one of the other small camps established around the enemy. Earlier in the day, they had made trails all over the valley, so that without the sticks stuck in the snow to mark the proper trail, none would know the way to those camps. The trail through the snow from all the men on foot would be easy for the enemy to follow. But they had plans to take care of that. In the distance, back toward the order, she saw the rear guard engaged in a pitched battle. Lieutenant Sloan was supposed to keep that from happening and keep the rear moving. Cursing anew, she galloped her horse back. Without pause, she charged between the two forces, spun, and charged through again, separating the two sides. The leather-clad Daharans fell back at the sight of the white spirit woman atop a white horse. She waded in among the Galeans. "What's the matter with you? You know the orders. Run, or you won't make it." The men started moving, trying to drag a body with them. "Where's Lieutenant Sloan? He's supposed to be back here." The men nodded to the body they were dragging. The side of the head was gone, and she could see the exposed brain. It was Lieutenant Sloan. The Daharans charged in again. She pulled the reins and Nick reared. The Daharans fell back once more. "He's dead. Leave him. Run! Run! Run, you idiots! If any of you stops again for anything, I'll make you fight the rest of this war naked. Now run!" This time they took off in earnest, kicking up snow, running for their lives. Again she swept past the line of drunken Daharans, causing them to stumble backward and fall over one another in panic. She had to stall these men to give her own time to gain enough of a lead. She ran Nick through the Daharans, trampling those who got in the way. The men scattered in momentary dread of the white spirit woman, some calling to the spirits for protection, but others came back swinging weapons. If they caught Nick's legs... She fought back with her sword and her warhorse as they closed around her. Her men were fading into the fog. "Run!" she bid them. "Run!" She swung the sword at men who reached out. The next time she glanced back, she saw nothing but dark fog and mist. She was losing her sense of direction as she wheeled Nick around, charging at the men, trying to buy her own men the time they needed to escape. She tried to break away, but the enemy swarmed around her, with more coming all the time. Some yelled at the others that she was just a woman and not a spirit, and they weren't going to let a woman get away. She felt more naked than she had felt all night. Men threw themselves around Nick's legs, and although he reared and kicked them off, even more took their place, staggering the big horse with their weight. Kaelin hacked furiously at the men, shearing off arms, splitting skulls, and stabbing bodies. With a sea of men all around her, she suddenly realized that her situation was untenable. She knew that if they got her off her horse, she was finished, and her horse was being hobbled. Try as she might, she couldn't get the men away. For the first time that night, she truly feared she wasn't going to make it. She was going to die here in the snow, in this mist-shrouded valley. She would never see Richard again. She felt an abrupt, icy pain in the bite on her neck. Darken Rawl's bite. She thought she heard quiet laughter in the air. She slashed away at the man grabbing for her. Powerful fingers clutched her legs. The pain of those fingers urged her into frantic stabbing. Nick managed to spin, the men's feet flying outward, but they held on tight. She slashed and hacked the arms. Moore caught hold of her horse's bit, taking control from her. A horse was valuable plunder, and they didn't want it killed as long as they thought they were in control of the situation. A big soldier grabbed the horn of her saddle, dragging himself up.
"Don't kill her! It's the Mother Confessor! Don't kill her! She must be alive when she's beheaded!"
She slashed the side of his neck. A fountain of hot blood gushed across her thigh. Another yelled,
"Don't kill her! Bring the bitch down!"
A cheer went up from the reaching men. She swung at the grasping hands. Fingers raked her legs. Eyes all around leered up at her. She slashed wildly as Nick stumbled sideways, trying to pull his head free, but the men held his bit tight. A man leapt up from behind and snatched her by the hair. She let out a cry as he yanked her backward off the saddle. Hands grappled her as she tumbled to the ground. Everyone went down in a pile under her. Big hands seized her by her legs, her waist, her ankles, and her breasts. Fingers wrapped around the blade, trying to wrench it from her. She twisted the hilt, severing the fingers. She swung and stabbed ferociously. Bodies pressed her to the cold ground, pressed the wind from her lungs. She bit the fingers covering her mouth. A huge fist struck her across the jaw. They finally seized her flailing arms. There were too many.
"Dear Richard, I love you."
Chapter 45. Kaelin struggled to draw a breath, but with the weight of men on her, she couldn't. Tears stung her eyes. More men piled on, a beefy elbow in her middle pressed into her, feeling as if it would squash her in two. Drunken breath bathed her face. Her vision dwindled to a small spot. Everything around the center was going black, and the center was shrinking. She swallowed a mouthful of blood, her own. She heard what sounded like the distant rumble of thunder. At first, she could only feel the vibration in her back against the ground. But then the sound swelled, growing louder, sharper. The screams of men reached her ears. Some of the men over her looked up. Their weight lifted a bit and she sucked air into her lungs. It was the sweetest breath she had ever known. As the giant of a man atop her, the one who had struck her face, turned to the sound of thunder, turned his fierce eye from her, she saw that his other had a scar across it and down his cheek. That empty eye was sewn shut. Somehow, her left hand squirmed free. She seized his throat. She heard a metallic rattle. The thunder, she suddenly realized, was horses' hooves. Erupting out of the fog, Bryn and Peter atop Daisy and Pip galloped at a full charge down the line of Daharans, mowing them down with the chain. They raced toward her like a landslide felling trees. The men stared in frozen shock. Kaelin's fingers clutched around the one-eyed man's throat. And then she released her power. The magic slammed into him. Thunder without sound rattled all the chainmail. The staggering jolt made the men flinch back. They all cried out with the pain of being so close as the magic was loosed. A ring of snow lifted, sweeping outward in a circle. Nick was standing over her, and he jumped with the pain, too. His hind leg came down on a man's head right next to her ear. Bone crunched under the weight. Hot blood and gore splattered the side of her face. The one eye of the man above gaped at her.
"Mistress,"
he whispered.
"Please command me.
Protect me,"
she screamed. He sat up abruptly, his massive muscles bulging. He held the hair of a man in each fist. He tossed them back as if they were mere children. Her sword arm was free. She swung at a man to the other side, the blade ruining his face. The one-eyed man roared as he tossed men aside. The draft horses rushed onward at a full charge. She was free of the hands. She leapt to her feet. The chain was almost upon them.
"Help me up on my horse!"
The one-eyed man grabbed her ankle in his big fist and with one arm boosted her up into the saddle. Somehow, she still had the sword in her hand. She leaned forward and swung it at the man holding the bit, holding his prize. The sword's tip sliced open the side of his face and half the length of his arm. He staggered back with a shriek. She snatched up the reins. The one-eyed man bellowed as he lopped off heads and ripped open chests with his huge war axe.
"Go, mistress! Escape! Orsk will protect you!"
"I'm going! Run, Orsk! Don't let them get you!"
The Daharans abandoned her and her horse to turn to the new threats, Orsk and the chain. She thumped Nick's ribs with her heels, urging him into a gallop just as Bryn and Peter caught up with her. She stuffed her bare feet into the stirrups as the three of them raced away. She spotted the trail that hundreds of feet had left in the snow and followed it across the valley into the mist, leaving the men of the Army of the Order to collect their wits. It took them mere seconds. They charged after her. There were more than enough still alive. Thousands. Peter unhooked the chain that must have broken hundreds of bones and necks. The end of the chain bounced behind. Bryn's bony fingers drew in the dragging slack and coiled it over the hame. As she galloped into the night, she thought she could hear the sound of soft laughter fading behind. She shivered with the memory of the kiss Darkin Rall had left on her neck. She felt suddenly very naked again. Though the mist was icy cold, feeling like sparkling flecks all over her, she was sweating. Blood ran from her swollen lip.
"I never thought I would see you two again,"
she yelled over the sound of hooves. Bryn and Peter, in their two big coats, grinned in the darkness.
"We told you we could do the job,"
Bryn said. She smiled for the first time that night.
"You two are a marvel."
She just caught sight of the hindquarters of the other draft horses disappearing into the fog. She pointed.
"There are your men. Good luck."
With a wave, they turned away from her. She galloped on alone, and a short distance later caught up with the men on foot. She first saw only one. He had a horrific gash on his leg and had fallen far behind. She knew she should leave him. She knew she should. The Daharans were right behind. As she rode up to him, he turned his head up as he struggled through the snow. He knew she had to leave him. Those were the orders, her orders, keep up or be left behind, no exceptions. As she rode by, she leaned over, extending her arm down. They clasped wrists, and she yanked him up behind her. Hold on, soldier. He held his arms out, trying to balance as the horse ran, afraid to touch her.
But where?
Around my waist. Put your arms around my waist. He still held his arms out as he bounced.
But haven't you ever put your arms around a woman before?
Yes, but she had clothes on,
he whined.
Do it or you'll fall off and I'm not coming back for you.
Reluctantly, carefully, he put his arms around her waist, stiffly, to keep them away from anything important or unfamiliarly exotic. Kalin gave the back of his hands a pat of reassurance. When you brag about this, don't make it more than it is. He let out a small, worried groan that made her smile. As they rode on, she could feel his warm blood running down the back of her leg, dripping from her toes in the stirrup. She could hear the shouts of the enemy chasing behind. He was losing a lot of blood. In exhaustion, he laid his head against the back of her shoulder. If they didn't tie his wound closed, he would bleed to death in short order. She was naked and had nothing to use as a bandage, even if they had the time to stop.
Hold the wound closed with a hand, she said. Clamp it closed as tight as you can, and hold fast to me with your other arm. I don't want you falling off.
He took one arm from her waist and held the gash closed as she rode right on the heels of the men at the end of the line. They were cold and fatigued. The men of the order were not far behind. As she looked back, they came into sight. She was shocked by the numbers. They hooted and hollered,
Run! Run, or we'll be caught!
A wall of rock, with scraggly trees growing from cracks and clefts, loomed up before them. The men ran up the narrow pass as if their lives depended on it. And they did. As they began the climb up the rift, she rang the flat of her sword 3 times on the rock, giving the signal. A man ahead turned as he ran.
We're not there yet. It's too soon. We'll be caught along with the enemy. Then you better run faster. If we wait too long, they will get through too.
She rapped the rock wall 3 more times, the ringing sound carrying into the dark, damp air. She hoped it would work. There, of course, had been no way to perform a test. The man ahead scrambled up the trail. Nick's hooves slipped in places on the snow-covered rock. At first she could only feel it, a rumbling deep in her chest, too low to hear, but too powerful not to be felt. She looked up along the mist-slicked rock that disappeared above into the dark and fog. She couldn't see it yet, but she could feel it. She hoped the man was wrong, that it wouldn't be too soon. When she heard the battle cries of the men coming from behind, she knew they had no choice. And then she could hear it, a booming roar, as if the ground itself were moving. She could hear tree trunks snapping. The thundering growl reverberated off the surrounding mountain walls. The ground vibrated.
Run! Can't you run any faster? Do you want to be buried alive? Run!
She knew they were going as fast as they could, but they were on foot, and from atop her horse, it seemed painfully slow. Deadly slow. Overhead, the rumbling roar grew louder as uncountable tons of snow crashed down toward them. She was thrilled that the men on top had been successful in starting an avalanche on command, but she was also terrified that she had given the command too soon. A lump of wet snow slapped her face. Another smacked her shoulder. Little clods rattled through the trees above them and bounced out over the edge. A cloud of fluffy snow misted her face. The roar was deafening. A flow of thundering white sluiced over the ledge above. They drove through it, like running through a waterfall. Behind her, a tree trunk bounced on the trail, spinning out over the precipice. They just cleared the leading edge of the bulk of snow. The men of the Imperial Order behind were not so lucky. The plunging snow, charged with timber and boulders, cascaded down with ever-gathering power. They were swept away in the tumbling white death. The fury of sound muffled the screams of men it carried away, rolling them into the pounding slide, burying them alive. Kalin sagged with relief. They could not be followed now. The pass was entombed. The panting men slowed, but they couldn't slow too much or they would freeze. Their pace kept them warm. Their feet, she knew, despite being wrapped in white cloth for a little protection, were not warm. They had given her their best effort. They had given the Midlands their best effort. Many had given their lives. Kaelin was so exhausted from lack of sleep, as well as the fatigue of battle, along with the emotional drain of fright and the effort required to use her power, that she could hardly stay upright. Soon, she told herself, she could rest. Soon. She patted the hand on her stomach. We made it, soldier. We're safe now.
Yes, Mother Confessor.
He whispered groggily.
Mother Confessor, I'm sorry.
For what?
I only killed 17. I'm sorry. I promised myself I'd get 20. I only got 17,
he mumbled. I know heroes of battle, decorated men, who would have not bested half that number in combat. You have made me proud. You have made the Midlands proud. Feel only pride, soldier. He mumbled something she couldn't understand. She patted his hand again. You'll be to help soon. Hold on. You'll be fine. He didn't answer. She looked behind down the trail and saw only white and heard only silence. In the distant, dark mountains, a wolf yipped. A short time later, on a high plateau, they reached the camp. The men ahead in the line were already wrapped in blankets as they shivered around fires, warming their feet. Some were pulling on their clothes under the blankets. More men threw blankets around the men coming in ahead of her and tended the wounded. Some of the wounded were groaning in pain, feeling it for the first time, now that the heady furor of combat and escape had evaporated. She began to feel a throbbing in her lip. In the flickering light of small fires, she could see Prindon and Tossadin, some distance away, running around searching the new arrivals. When they saw her on the horse, they both sighed with relief, giving her twin smiles. Captain Ryan, dressed in a Dharan uniform and with a bandage around his left hand, ran over. Other men took the reins, and yet others extended their hands to take the man behind her as she held him by an elbow, lowering the limp form down. Prindon ran to meet her, her mantle in hand. He stood, holding it open for her, waiting for her to dismount so he could put it around her shoulders. He grinned at her. Without moving from the saddle, she slowly extended her hand. I have had enough eyes on my flesh to last me the rest of my life. Throw it up here. Prindon shrugged self-consciously and tossed the mantle up to her. Tossadin swatted the back of his brother's head. Silence fell over the gathered men. They all looked away in embarrassment as she put the mantle around her shoulders and tied it. She slid down, finding her legs barely up to the task of holding her. She used the sword still in her hand as a cane. She had to pause a moment until everything stopped spinning. She glanced to the men lying in the snow at her feet. Why isn't someone helping this man? Don't just stand there. Help him. No one moved. I said help him. Captain Ryan stepped closer to her. He kept his eyes on the ground. I'm sorry, Mother Confessor. He's dead.